From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! U.S. ally Mobutu Sese Seko leaves Zaire. Is this the end of the 32-year dictatorship? As President Clinton prepares for his Caribbean summit, we look at bananas, beaches, and bases. And we remember the radical Brazilian educator, Paulo Freire.
If it seems like this, go on, in some time, we will have a small elite commanding science and technology and a fantastic multitude of ignorant people.
We talk with feminist author Bell Hooks.
I wanted to ask Paulo about all of those, you know, comments about liberation being about men coming into their humanity and manhood. And when I did, people immediately tried to silence me. And he won my heart forever because he said, you know, stop. What are you trying to do? This, you shouldn't. She's absolutely right to question. That's what I am saying in my work. And for that moment, I mean, he was such an incredible embodiment of who he was as a teacher and as a human being.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Leaving a capital that is bracing for the arrival of rebel forces trying to topple him, Mobutu Sese Seko flew to neighboring Gabon today on an official visit that many Zaireans saw as his final departure from the country he has ruled for nearly 32 years. We'll have more on Zaire-Congo later in the show. And this news from the United States, the Senate voted 89-11 to postpone the cutoff of benefits to legal immigrants. The action would only delay the scheduled August cutoffs until the end of September, but it marked the first backtracking from last year's overhaul of the nation's welfare programs, and the size of the vote indicates the issue has become a sensitive one for Republicans. The recent budget pact with the White House promises an additional $10 billion to maintain the benefits over 5 years, but the cost threatens to provoke a GOP backlash. During negotiations to end a lengthy strike by workers at an engine plant, Chrysler Corporation insisted it would not relinquish its right to farm out production jobs to an independent supplier. Chrysler apparently got what it wanted, but at a hefty price. Industry analysts estimate a 28-day walkout by the United Auto Workers will cost the company about $300 million in lost production. This news from Charleston, South Carolina. Three men pleaded guilty to enslaving migrant farm workers, admitting to a conspiracy in which the workers were beaten and threatened if they protested their conditions. All three admitted to recruiting Guatemalans and Mexicans from Chandler Heights, Arizona, according to the Justice Department. Prosecutors said the undocumented workers were driven to Manning, South Carolina, about 60 miles southeast of Columbia, without being allowed to eat or use the restroom. The workers were paid little. It was virtually impossible for them to pay off the high fees for housing essential goods and for transporting them across the country. This news from Oklahoma, a 22-year-old man who asked a court to schedule his execution was killed by injection early today, the youngest person to be put to death since capital punishment was reinstated in 1976. Scott Don Carpenter, who pleaded no contest to stabbing a store clerk to death, apologized in a letter to the victim's family and left a statement. He said, "I tell the young and old, do not stray onto the wrong path in life as I did. I speak from experience when I say it's a long and bumpy road with a lot of regret and few second chances." 2 years after the Million Man March in Washington, a group called on 1 million black women to attend a similar rally in Philadelphia this fall. The National Organizing Committee for the Million Woman March said the October 25th rally was designed to raise awareness of several issues, education and health care in black communities, and the difficult transition after prison for black women. The march also would be in support of a probe led by Congressmember Maxine Waters of California into published reports of links between the CIA and crack cocaine suppliers in California. And finally, 2 weeks after the end of the hostage crisis, 24 Peruvian miners who dug the tunnels used by government commandos to rescue 71 people from the Japanese ambassador's residence and kill all the rebels have not returned home, this according to their union. The union sent a letter to the government-owned Centroman Mining Company, which hired the miners and engineers, asking it to say where the men are and to let them return to their family. News reports have said that two of the miners were killed or injured building the tunnels, and the secretive nature of the operation has led families to fear for their safety. Centroman would not comment on the miners' whereabouts. The miners spent several weeks digging a network of tunnels under the residence where the rebels held the hostages. The military used the tunnels to stage the April 26 rescue, in which one hostage and two soldiers died. The 14 rebels who seized the hostages also were killed. It is believed a number of them executed. The union said the company began recruiting miners for the job on January 5th, offering to pay them $2,000 each. So far, the miners' families have only received $1,000, and they have not received the miners back. You're listening to Democracy Now! President Clinton heads down to the Eastern Caribbean tomorrow for a meeting with regional leaders in Bridgetown, Barbados. Like his trip to Central America this week, President Clinton will be dealing with issues related to trade, immigration, and the militarization of the drug war. Joining us to talk about some of these questions is Ricky Singh, a Caribbean journalist and columnist based in Bridgetown, Barbados. He's written for most of the Caribbean's leading newspapers and is the regional affairs correspondent for the Caribbean news agency known as CANA. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning and welcome to you.
Well, it's good to be hearing from you in Barbados. Can you tell us what you see as the major issues of the Caribbean that President Clinton and the Caribbean leaders should be dealing with?
They have a common position in the fight against illicit drugs and money laundering. And the American administration has been very consistent in it, collaborating with the Caribbean region in ensuring the trafficking of cocaine and other drugs into the United States must be curbed as effectively as possible. Current estimates place drugs passing through the Caribbean as about 40% of total consumption in the United States and Europe. The Caribbean countries have no problem in cooperating with the United States and Europe on these matters. But what they have been focusing on primarily is a question of trade and economic aid, because that is very vital to their very survival. And they are coming around to a position which is being articulated as the linkage between the fight against drugs and economic reforms and trade liberalization.
What does the drug war mean for militaries in the Caribbean?
In terms of what?
Well,
I mean, in terms of their response,
one of the things that activists have been talking about in Mexico, as President Clinton has been there for the last few days, is that when money is poured into the drug war, what it actually does is militarize society and strengthen militaries to deal more than just with drugs, but to deal with.
Okay, right. I'm with you. There's a distinction between money for fight drugs in Latin America and that of the Caribbean region, because monies allocated to the Caribbean by the United States or Europe or Canada for fighting drugs go directly to the government and have to be identified in terms of disbursements. So there's no question of it adding to any kind of militarization of the society. There are specific safeguards against that.
Can you talk a little about, Ricky Singh, the Ship Rider Agreement and what this means for listeners who are not aware of it at all?
The Ship Riders Agreement is basically the United States approach to the use of Caribbean territorial waters and airspace in hot pursuits primarily of drug traffickers or suspected drug traffickers Most of the Eastern Caribbean territories have already signed on to that agreement, but Jamaica and Barbados have been resisting that until recently because they were not comfortable with the provisions because it impinges on their jurisdictional sovereignty. And the United States has had to go through the process of renegotiating those agreements. They have succeeded in doing that with Jamaica earlier this week, and they have signed on to it. And they are in the process of concluding a similar agreement with Barbados today. And hopefully that will be signed next week. The intention was to get out of the way the controversies relating to the shipwrights agreement with the United States prior to the Caribbean-USA summit, which begins here in Barbados on Saturday. They did not want the issues to be confused because they were very contentious issues. Happily, they have been resolved in a manner that satisfies both the United States, Jamaica, and Barbados.
I know that the late Chetty Jagan, president of Guyana, while he signed on to the shipwrights agreement, had serious misgivings about it for basically allowing the U.S. to control the sea waves of the Caribbean. And Barbados has held out the longest, hasn't, of any Caribbean nation?
Yes, you're right. And that is because they have been insisting on provisions such as compensation, reciprocity in terms of whether, although, I mean, it may look of academic interest to some people, that you want reciprocal arrangements with the world's sole superpower. But what they, in fact, is a matter of principle. If your vessels are going to come into our waters or territorial space, then we must have a similar right in the event that we have to engage in hot pursuit as well. Then the more serious issue was compensation, because the original draft was very vague and there was a real danger that these small island states may have been held accountable in the event of wrongful arrest and so forth, damage to property in the course of carrying out anti-drugged operations.
Let me end by asking you this large question, which is the effect of NAFTA on the Caribbean, where the Caribbean Base Initiative fits in, and where the U.S. policy toward Cuba, how it affects, for example, your country of Barbados.
Well, first, the original aspect of your question, that is that NAFTA has had a negative effect on Caribbean's trade with the United States, because it has had the effect of undermining the gains that were originally provided for under the Caribbean Base Initiative that was introduced by President Reagan, because that agreement still excludes about 13 major commodities from the duty-free concessions, among them apparel, textile, leather goods, petroleum, petroleum-based products. These are major sources of employment and foreign exchange. So it has hurt us because, as you know, the NAFTA agreement has extended certain concessions to Mexico, and Mexico has been eroding our little market that we have with the United States. So that is going to be an area of serious discussion, which, in fact, it's not going to be a new discussion. It's going to be a revisiting of an old discussion that they had first in 1994. And they're looking forward to President Clinton giving some ground there. Alternatively, if they can enhance the CBI to take care of these problems while they're discussing the larger issue of the coming free trade area of the Americas.
And Cuba?
And Cuba is, both sides significantly are trying their very best to avoid discussing it in any official way. But informally, Cuba is very much there, and I suspect it will surface in the plenary session on Saturday morning. The scenario here is that the United States has not requested to be on the agenda, sensing resentment from the Caribbean delegations. But in the event that the United States exercises its right to put it on the agenda, then the Caribbean will introduce the Helms-Burton Act in terms of its negative impact on the Caribbean and its right to engage in free trade. So that is where it is at the present time. You need to know, and your listeners need to know, that Cuba is the only Caribbean nation that is not going to be present for this summit, as happened in 1994 at the Summit of the Americas. And that is not a that is not a position that the Caribbean governments are happy with, because Cuba has diplomatic relations with all the independent Caribbean states and is a member of the Association of Caribbean States. And therefore, they would have liked Cuba to be involved, but it would have been a very contentious issue, and there was a real possibility that if they had raised it initially, the President of the United States may not have agreed to come to the Caribbean for the summit.
Ricky Singh, I want to thank you very much for joining us from Bridgetown, Barbados, where you are a Caribbean journalist and columnist, writing for many of the Caribbean's leading newspapers. Thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to be of help.
Thank you. As we move on to another issue in the Caribbean, U.S. officials have been pushing a plan to build a series of satellite military bases throughout the Caribbean. Pentagon and Coast Guard officials say they need the bases as part of the war on drugs, but the move has sparked widespread opposition in the Caribbean, especially on the island of Petite Martinique, a small island of 800 people that is part of Grenada. We're joined now by Professor Paul Clement. He's an economist in New York at the Fashion Institute of Technology, but he's also the public relations officer for the Petite Martinique Interest Group. He is from that island, and we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much, Amy.
Well, it may surprise some to know that the U.S. wants to establish a new base in this tiny island of Petite Martinique. Tell us a little about what's going on there.
Yes, Petite Martinique is only 586 acres. On January 1996, U.S. Marines appeared on the children's playground, which is the only flat piece of land on that island, planting sticks. They were approached by the people because the people were alarmed. And they were told by the U.S. Marines that that they were coming to the island to build a U.S. Coast Guard base. So the people protested, and the Prime Minister, Dr. Keith Mitchell, later came to the island and told the people that the base will be built in April of 1997. The people continued to protest, and as last month in April 1997, what happened was the three Coast Guards were dispatched with over 100 a special services unit, which is called the SSU, heavily armed policemen. And the people sat down on the site, and what happened was a clash between the police and the people. Several people were brutalized, and two persons were arrested. What we had following that is the landing of over 100 U.S. Marines with over 30 motorized vehicles on the island. This island has a population of 800 people. The adult population is 400. So we actually looking at an increase, immediate increase in the population of around 25% just in one day. The clash between the police and the people led the opposition parties in Grenada. That is, four opposition parties came together, which is historic in the history of Grenada, to formulate a resolution that was sent to the President of the United States, as well as Prime Minister Keith Mitchell, condemning and asking for consultation and dialogue between the people and the government. The government have so far refused to acknowledge any type of dialogue or approve any type of consultation with the people in this matter. So the people are continuing to protest.
Do you know why the government chose Petite Martinique, the U.S. government, to build a base on?
Well, Dennis Carter, the U.S. representative on Grenada, on a Voice of America program on March 26, 1997, told the world that the purpose of this project on Petite Martinique is, and I quote, for a training venue for United States troops to support projects such as military exercises such as Trade Winds and Carib 97, which is military exercises between the United States troops and Caribbean forces.
Well, we have to break, but when we come back, I just want to ask you quickly, how people are organizing on Petite Martinique right now and what they're asking for people in the U.S. to do, and get a phone number from you. And then we're going to move on to the issue of Zaire, with the dictator Mobutu Sese Seko leaving Zaire. Is this it for him? And finally, we'll remember Paulo Freire. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're just finishing up our conversation with economist Paul Clement from Petite Martinique. He heads up the Petite Martinique Interest Group, and I was just asking you what the people of Petite Martinique are asking people of the United States to do.
The people of Petite Martinique are asking the people of the United States and the people of the world to write to President Clinton, to contact their congressman, like in Major Owens in Brooklyn, and put pressure on the U.S. government, since the U.S. government is sponsoring that, and also environmentalists, because the latest news coming out of the island is that the U.S. Marines did not come prepared to handle the waste materials, and the people are suffering from eye irritation and nausea because of the mixing of human waste and being burnt on the island. And this is in the middle of the smack in the middle of the a community such as Times Square, that would be similar to burning human waste in the middle of Times Square. And the people are asking the world to support them. And the telephone number you can call, 718-756-8948.
One more time.
718-756-8948, or an email address, savepm@aol.com. That's savepm@aol.com.
Well, I want to thank you again, Professor Paul Clement, economist and head of the Petite Martinique Interest Group.
Thank you very much.
You got to be a millionaire or some kind of petty bourgeoisie anytime you live in here. In this country, you got to be in skullduggery, making your money illicitly to live like somebody. In this country, it's outrageous and insane. Them crazy prices in Port of Spain, and like the merchants going out their brain, and the working man like the only toiling in vain. Where you ever hear a television for 7,000, $250,000 for live peace and land? A pair of sneakers, $200, $80,000-$90,000 for motor cars. At last, here in Trinidad, we see capitalism gone mad. It's sad and getting more bad, because capitalism gone mad.
And that is the Mighty Sparrow singing Capitalism Gone Mad. Well, we're going to move from the Caribbean right now to Zaire, what will be called the Congo. The 32-year-long rule of Zairean dictator Mobutu Sese Seko appears to be over. The ailing president flew to neighboring Gabon yesterday as the Rebel Alliance of Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Congo, led by Laurent Kabila, threatened to move on to the Zairean capital, Kinshasa. Meanwhile, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Bill Richardson, as well as U.N., British, and French officials, have been maneuvering to manage the political transition from a government led by their longtime ally, the 66-year-old Mobutu, to one headed by Laurent Kabila, a longtime guerrilla leader and foe of Mobutu. Joining us to talk about events in Zaire, which is considered one of the richest countries in the world, are two guests. We're joined by Rakia Omar, the co-director of African Rights, a human rights organization based in London, England. And we're joined by Ron Walters, a professor of African American Studies and Government and Politics at the University of Maryland in College Park there. He's also the vice president of the Constituency for Africa, a nonprofit group now headed by former New York City Mayor David Dinkins that seeks to educate Americans about Africa. Rakia Omar, let's talk with you first. Do you see this, the leaving of Mobutu Sese Seko from Zaire, as the end of his 32-year rule?
Well, I certainly hope so, but I think Mobutu's ability to manipulate events should not be written off. I mean, he says he's coming back. He says he's getting arms from the other French-speaking countries in the region. I hope he fails for the sake of the Zairean people and for the sake of peace and stability in Africa. But I think it would be unwise to write him off completely. He's a man of immense wealth, and he's a man whose thirst for power has brought his country to its knees. So I certainly hope it is the end, and I think everything should be done to make sure that he is in no position to undertake any further adventures, but I would be cautious.
Rakia Omar, you wrote an interesting piece in The Guardian just recently called A Bitter Harvest. Could the latest horrors in Zaire have been prevented? And you argue yes, and you accuse the UN High Commission of Refugees of denying justice to the innocent. Can you talk about what the latest horrors have been and why you're pointing the finger?
Well, the latest horrors, of course, refer to the suffering of the Rwandese Hutu refugees in eastern Zaire, whose plight has been immortalized on television screens around the world and in newspaper articles, some of whom have been killed, some of whom have died from hunger and are malnourished and tired and exhausted. And I believe that there have been two kinds of Rwandese in eastern Zaire since 1994. One set of people are fugitives from justice, the people who planned and implemented the genocide of 1994, who fled in July 1994, not because they had a well-founded fear of persecution, but a well-founded fear of justice. And then there were the refugees, people who had not killed in the genocide, but who were terrified out of their country through a well-organized political flight by the same people who committed the genocide, who wanted to frighten the Hutu population out of Rwanda, essentially as a strategy of war by other means, having won the genocide against the Tutsi population, but having lost the war against the Rwandese Patriotic Front. They wanted to empty the country of the Hutu population, who are the majority in Rwanda, to deprive the Rwandese Patriotic Front of a population to govern, of therefore of a sense of legitimacy and, of course, of international recognition and support. And these same people turned the camps into extremely violent places where they continued to kill and to threaten refugees who wanted to go back to Rwanda, where they continued to launch very devastating attacks against Rwanda, killing survivors of the genocide, targeting Hutus who were prepared to work with the new government, destabilizing the country and sowing panic and insecurity and instability. And they did this from camps that were established by the international community. They did this in an area essentially governed by the international community. And they did this with the resources available to them, made available to them by the United Nations agencies and by the relief organizations. And I believe that of course, they could not have consider the political asylum rights of each refugee as hundreds of thousands of people were fleeing in July 1994. But I think once this emergency was over, justice, that is engaging with the mechanisms that would have brought the fugitives among the population to justice, should have been the overriding responsibility of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, whose responsibility is international protection of refugees, not the distribution of medicines and blankets to all and sundry who happen to have crossed an international border. And I believe it is their decision to stay in the camps no matter what, to turn a blind eye to the murderous activities of genocidal criminals that is responsible for what has unfolded in Eastern Zaire today.
That's Rakia Omar, co-director of African Rights. We're speaking to her in London. Professor Ron Walters, do you share Rakia Omar's beliefs and who's responsible here?
Yes, I do. Certainly, I think she has the correct analysis on it and intimately involved in looking at that situation in Eastern Zaire. I think as we talk today, situation in Eastern Zaire, some people are even saying that in the midst of the military action is being turned into a bloodbath. So there's even increased, I think, urgency and attention to that region needed as we look at the events in Zaire today.
Well, Professor Walters, let me ask you on a slightly different subject, though, of course, related, about Laurent Kabila right now, who's moving in on Kinshasa. Can you talk about what he has done most recently? One is the nationalization of the railroads and yet also the signing of massive multi-million dollar agreements with major mining corporations.
Yes, well, it's unclear exactly what all of this means. Of course, the signing of many of these agreements with the multinational corporations took place before he moved in and nationalized the railroads. And many thought that what he was doing was to try to shore up the economic health of the country and to give confidence to many of the Western countries that might have been concerned about his position toward their role in a new Zaire, to give them some confidence to support his revolution so that he signed these agreements. The most cynical, of course, of interpretations of that was that he was seeking to enrich himself, put himself in a position, in fact, to be another Mobutu. So there was some concern about, and there still is some concern about these agreements with multinational corporations. On the other hand, his nationalization of the railroads, many people thought was either an attempt to actually shore up this line of concern with an attention to economic problems, primarily because in any large-scale scheme of economic development, from the Jacquemin's mining complexes to others that are a part of European and American consortia, they need the railroads. And therefore, I think what he might have been trying to signal was that not only was he going to make it possible for these deals that he's worked out to actually work by seizing the railroads, but that he was also sending a signal that he wanted to use these railroads in his military campaigns.
Yeah,
if he was able to
yeah.
cut off the lifeline mm-hmm. of the Mobutu government by seizing these railroads, the political act of nationalization wasn't anything. He was saying that I have the power to actually take this railroad, especially the southern half of it. And that, I think, was the more convincing point.
I mean, I think I agree with that completely. But I also think, it, you know, people forget that Kabila is actually engaged in a war, that his
That's right.
overriding concern has been to win, to show that he can win the war decisively on the battlefield, thereby essentially forcing Mobutu either out of the country or to stumble towards the negotiating table. And he wanted to do that, as so many other political leaders in the world have done, by showing that he has the cards in his hands militarily. And so I think one of the other obvious reasons for signing the agreements with the multinationals was he needs to finance his war. And I think anyone who expects somebody in the midst of a war to not to give primary consideration to having the resources to sustain that military objective, I think is being somewhat naive under the circumstances.
Yes. On the other hand, I think it might have been a political miscalculation. And again, this has led some people to question his politics, that is his political acumen, not his politics, primarily because traditionally and historically, South Africa has owned part of the railroad. And as a matter of fact, the trade between South Africa and Zaire has been conducted partially by that railroad. So here is Nelson Mandela, who is playing a role in the negotiations on both sides. And I'm sure that this issue of the future of this railroad has been one of the issues on the table.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's possible, absolutely.
We're talking to Ricky Omar, co-director of African Rights, and Professor Ron Walters, professor of African American Studies at the University of Maryland. About a week ago, there was a piece in the New York Times about U.S. intelligence sources saying that the French are continuing to support Mobutu Sese Seko with mercenaries through secret covert operations in Zaire. Do either of you know anything about this?
Well, my contacts with the secret services anywhere in the world is non-existent, so I have no idea what those reports are based on. But I am absolutely 100% sure that the French are continuing to search for every possible means to shore up Mobutu, rhetoric to the contrary notwithstanding, and that they are not going to give up on their anti-Kabila and anti-Rwanda politics, even if Kabila gets into power and it is a fait accompli. The victory of the Rwandese Patriotic Front in Rwanda was a severe political shock for the French, and of course a devastating embarrassment for them to, in inverted commas, lose Zaire so soon afterwards to as the same sort of alliance, if you like, of political leaders that are very critical of French policy, whether the Rwandese Patriotic Front, President Museveni of Uganda, and of course Kabila, is something that is extremely difficult for the French government and many members of the French opposition and even many people among the French media, etc., to accept. And I think the French are trying, even through some of the NGOs that they give money to and support through journalists, in every possible way to try to undermine the prospect of a political victory for the anti-Mobutu forces in Zaire. And not necessarily because they continue to think that he is genuinely the best leader for the people of Zaire, they can't possibly think that, but because their own narrow political interests in Zaire, and much more importantly, the wider implications of yet another political defeat for the French in West Africa, I think is something they absolutely cannot swallow.
You know, the West is very much coming out, it seems, in many ways with a kind of disinformation campaign, or I want to get your sense of it, sort of critical look at Laurent Kabila. They're already calling for democratic elections there, saying that he could be worse than Mobutu Sese Seko. Professor Ron Walters, what's your take on this?
Well, I think that we have to be clear about one thing, that is that as you see the political transition taking place in Zaire from Mobutu to the Kabila forces, I think that you also are experiencing a political transition from French patronage to United States patronage. And I think that going back here to, I very much agree with the analysis of the Rwandese Patriotic Front, and as a matter of fact, the objectives of the French. I was in Paris last fall, and the French were absolutely angry about any hint of the United States interest in the situation and the role that they were playing. Together with the Ugandans and so forth. Now, of course, you have the United States playing a very intense role in the negotiations. Bill Richardson, of course, was just in Gabon, as we read in the papers today, is on his way to Paris. The French are reported to be saying that they and the United States are on the same page with respect to the objectives here. one really wonders, and I think that it's certainly clear that given the long patronage of the French in this area, they certainly do not want to lose what has certainly been considered to be the largest prize in Zaire. So mm-hmm. while I think that on the surface, they probably have no recourse but to go along with what's happening on the ground, because that's a reality. I think by other means, they probably are working to try to retain
absolutely.
Whatever residual influence they have.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Next week, we are going to take a look at the effect of Mobutu Sese Seko leaving on the rest of Africa and what this means to have a Mobutu-less Africa. We've been speaking with Ron Walters, a professor of African-American Studies in Government and Politics at the University of Maryland, and also Rakia Omar, the co-director of African Rights, a human rights organization based in London, England. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to remember a great educator, the Brazilian radical philosopher Paulo Freire. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Paulo Freire, the Brazilian education activist, died last week in Albert Einstein Hospital in Sao Paulo, Brazil. He was 75 years old. It would be hard to overemphasize the impact of Paulo Freire's work. His best-selling book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, influenced activists and educators worldwide. In teaching, Paulo Freire sought to generate among students critical thinking. He believed that students should be active participants and not passive consumers in the education process. He refined his education methods beginning in the late 1950s during literacy campaigns among peasants in the poverty-stricken northeast of Brazil. In teaching literacy, he wanted to generate in his students a critical comprehension of reality, as he called it. In applying his techniques, he and his many disciples made use of terms like land and hunger, which they selected because the words related to the students' political and social setting when they taught reading and writing to workers and peasants. His philosophy has been used throughout Africa. He spent a lot of time in particularly the Portuguese-speaking countries of Africa. His literacy ideas were used in Nicaragua during the time of the Sandinistas, during the literacy campaigns, as well as in Cuba, and also throughout the United States. Right now, we're going to hear just an excerpt, a couple of sentences of Paulo Freire just a few years ago. He was speaking at the Harvard Graduate School of Education.
We have to be much more demanding concerning what means to learn and what means to teach. If things like this go on, in some time we will have a small elite commanding science and technology and a fantastic multitude of ignorant people.
That's Paulo Freire just a few years ago in Boston, Massachusetts, at Harvard Graduate School of Education. And his effect is really hard to calculate right now, except that all over the world he is known. Yesterday, I had a chance to go over to the apartment of Bell Hooks in Greenwich Village. She is an author, cultural critic, and feminist, and she was deeply moved by and influenced by Paulo Freire. I talked to her about her remembrance of him.
Well, like many people who have studied Paulo Freire, I first came to his work through reading his books, and then when I was in graduate school, he came to the University of California, Santa Cruz, and I was, at that time, I just published my first book, Ain't I a Woman, Black Woman, and Feminism, and people actually tried to keep me out of what was going to be a small group of 25 people meeting Paulo Freire because they didn't want feminist issues to intrude upon this man of this, you know, great educator coming from another country. And someone said, this is just absurd. This is what education is all about. And they gave me their slot. And sure enough, you know, I wanted to ask Paulo about all of those, you know, comments about liberation being about men coming into their humanity and manhood. And when I did, people immediately tried to silence me. And he won my heart forever because he said, you know, stop. What are you trying to do? This, you shouldn't. She's absolutely right to question. That's what I am saying in my work. And for that moment, I mean, he was such an incredible embodiment of who he was as a teacher and as a human being in the world that he said, look, I'm writing about openness and interrogation and the fact that people should be able to ask questions, that that's what learning is about. So I don't want anybody keeping someone from asking me difficult questions about my work. And that was the beginning of my personal relationship with Paulo Freire, which continued. And, you know, over the years that we talked about the way I was trying to bring a feminist component to education for critical consciousness, because so many of the men that have been influenced by Paulo's thinking have not wanted to move it forward, even though he has championed the notion of moving it in a more progressive direction around language, in relation to gender, around how we think about liberation.
He talks about being a man and manhood and realizing that. How did he respond to you that first time?
He responded by saying this was his beliefs at a particular point in time, that he had considered, you know, rewriting some of the early work, but that he decided that the best gesture for him to make would be to honor the critiques of that and to change. And so when you read later works like Pedagogy of the City and, you know, the sort of books that are much more recent, you see a complete change in how he uses examples that he uses, and not that sort of upholding of a kind of patriarchal masculinity that is so there in the early work.
How did he influence your teaching, your beliefs in education?
Well, the most wonderful gift that Paulo ever gave to me was seeing him embody the beliefs in his books, because I think that in our culture, so often people teach beliefs, values, ideas that have no relationship to how they live their lives. And each of the many times that I saw Paulo, I saw him exemplify again and again a unity between theory and praxis. And that has inspired me both as an intellectual and as a teacher to want to have that kind of unity, to believe that and to know that it's not a dream or a fantasy, but that you can teach by being in the world as much as you can by the books you write and what have you, if not more so.
Everyone talks about Pedagogy of the Oppressed, talking about how he believed that education and learning to read and write was for liberation. But what was the technique he actually taught?
Well, one of the big messages of Paulo Freire is that the techniques have to vary depending on the circumstance. I mean, one of the books of Paulo Freire that people don't read a lot are the Letters to Guinea-Bissau, where he goes there to be a part of the liberation struggle to encourage literacy. And he is so insistent that people have to begin their strategizing for education where they are, in the specificity of their nation, their tribe, their country, their what have you. And I think that is a misunderstanding that many people have about Freire, because they only read Pedagogy of the Oppressed, and they don't look at all the other things that he did that show his own growth and development.
I see you have Pedagogy of the City with you, one of Paulo Freire's later books. How does this differ from his first, Pedagogy of the Oppressed?
Well, I think that one particular aspect that is throughout his later works is Paulo began to talk a great deal more about the place of love in liberation struggle and pleasure. And I had this book here because I was reading this great quote from him where he says, "I think that the task of liberty, the task of liberation, the history as possibility, the understanding of the conscious and sensual body full of life necessarily demands a pedagogy of contentment." So that I think part of how he underwent a certain kind of feminist transformation as a thinker was that he began to really value and write about in his later work much more the kind of values of affirmation and nurturance that he felt in his life had come from women, and that he as a man needed to learn and embody, and that his sons needed to embody. And we see so much more of talking about domesticity and the value of domesticity and intellectual exchange. Paulo had two wives, his longtime wife Elsa, and then the later wife Nita. And one of the things that he did in both those choices was to talk about, in his later books, what it means to have a comrade. He talks about death and dying more, because the loss of Elsa was a very, very devastating loss in his life. And I think all of those things make him unique among male intellectuals globally, that we see him bringing into the work itself aspects of the personal that is political that so many male intellectuals never do.
Bell Hooks, in your book, Teaching to Transgress, Education is the Praxis of Freedom, you use a quote of Paulo Freire. What was that quote?
In the introduction to Teaching to Transgress, there's a quote that precedes the entire book, and it says that this capacity to begin always anew, to make, to reconstruct, and to not spoil, to refuse to bureaucratize the mind, to understand and to live life as a process, live to become, is something that always accompanied me throughout life.
So you met him first at University of California, Santa Cruz, when you made your way into this session you were not supposed to be a part of. When else did you actually meet with him?
Well, because we began a friendship then, I met with him different times that he came to the States, but I was also at different conferences that Paulo Freire was at. I felt like one of the reasons my relationship with Paulo was important to me was that it was so intergenerational, and that I could accept aspects of him that came both from the different cultural milieus. Like I used to ask Paulo, well, you know, do you consider yourself white or are you a brown person? And, you know, he was always willing to, like, rise and also be truthful. I think one of the major lessons he also taught me is to claim one's class privilege, one's positionality as it truly is, and not to feel that somehow if you have privilege, as he had throughout his later life, that you can't also be progressive and be radical but that you have to be honest about the nature of that privilege. That's why I think the letters to Guinea-Bissau are so crucial as a way that he maps out how people who may have certain privilege go into a context of so-called underdevelopment use their resources to educate people whose experiences of life may be radically different from their own.
How did his years in exile, years not being able to be in Brazil because of a military coup, how did that affect him?
I think part of what exile did with Paulo was deepen his compassion and deepen his sense of himself as being part of a world culture. I think that it's awesome, really, when you think about how much his work has affected so many different people around the world. and that capacity to speak across boundaries seems to me, and he and I often talked about this, to be something that came from those years spent in displacement, in exile, in a kind of classic postmodern sort of space of constant change and fragmentation and a sense of loss.
Bell Hooks, author, cultural critic, and feminist, deeply influenced by Paulo Freire as she remembers the great Brazilian education activist. And in these last few moments that we have left, we wanted to turn to Herb Cole, who is now in San Francisco, also an educator and an author of more than 30 books on education, including the books 36 Children and I Won't Learn From You. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Herb. You've just heard the conversation with Bell Hooks. Your final thoughts on your friend Paulo Freire?
Well, I think the one thing that hasn't been spoken enough, well, two things, is that Paulo was both a very, very spiritual person and that a lot of his work has had an enormous effect upon the radical church, in particular the radical Catholic Church throughout the world, because Paulo's reverence was very much an important part of his work. But the other thing was that he was also a revolutionary, and it's very important to understand that most of his life and work was done in the context of trying to change the world with risk. And one of the things that Paulo talks about all the time is that you can't do education of the people unless you yourself as an educator is going to take risks with the people. So I think that's really one of the central parts of his way of looking at the world. The other way is that he talks about problem-posing education, that the goal is not to answer the questions, but to be able to really help people raise the questions which they will answer themselves, you know?
You did a piece, Herb Cole, in Rethinking Education, a magazine,
Rethinking Schools,
called Nurturing One's Dreams. It was a review of Paulo Freire's book, Pedagogy of Hope. Is that his last book? I know it was out in 1994.
It's the last published book. I believe he was writing until he died, but it's a book in which he tries to reconsider what is going to happen as an educator who really is for people who are poor and oppressed in the context of soft democracy throughout the world. In the context of the pretense, I just heard it on the news this morning. Isn't it nice we have democracy throughout Latin America? No, we have poverty throughout Latin America. So the struggle goes on. And so what Paulo was doing right before he died is rethinking how education and the struggle can be reconceptualized in very, very changed circumstances. And I think that in a way he ended up his life an enormous amount of pain because of the defeats that a lot of movements for fundamental justice suffered over the past 15 years, over the past 5 years in particular. So what was most devastating to me about losing Paulo is that at this particular moment, we need his thinking more than ever.
Last note, and we just have, about a minute for you to answer it, and that is, President Clinton prides himself on being an education president, as did President Bush before him. President Clinton talks a lot about linking schools up around this country to the Internet. What do you think Paulo Freire would have to say to Bill Clinton?
Well, he just as soon, I'm not sure he'd have much to say to Bill Clinton. I certainly know that anything Paulo would have to say, Bill Clinton wouldn't listen to. Nevertheless, I think that Paulo would say that education is not for world-class standards, it's for world-class children. And that Paulo, the beauty of Paulo's work is that it is rooted in people, not in process, and it is not getting people to serve the needs of corporate and larger interests. It's trying to find a way for people to build their own communities, and in the course of that, build a life that's decent from them. And I think Clinton might look at him with a great big question mark on his face.
Well, Herb Cole, I want to thank you very much for joining us again, educator and author for many years in this country. Well, that brings us to the end of the show. Tomorrow, we're going to be speaking about tobacco with Ralph Nader and then go to the Green Party candidate who is running for Bill Richardson's seat in New Mexico. We also hope to speak with the Democrat and Republican. We'll see if we can get them on board. If you'd like a copy of today's show and to order a copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Our engineer and assistant producer is Errol Maitland. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. And thanks to Samori Marksman. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!